the complete space station now. So, figuring that 15-year, initial 15-year from completion, you know they're going to add at least five years to that. So 20 years down the road, you'll still be looking at the space station going overhead there.
Mission football.
Yeah, I've got a couple of questions, too. I'm going to ask mine first, John. When I'm looking at this beautiful picture at Scientific American, page 72, of not only the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, but they show you a picture of the International Space Station and the place where it's going to go. On the north side of the space station, I see 8 great big solar panels. On the south side of the space station, I see 8 big solar panels. But in the middle, I see something that looks like solar panels, 3 of them, but they stick out at a crazy angle like they're not used for solar panels. Maybe they're thermal radiators or something else. Any idea what I'm looking at? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, they're the thermal radiators. You see them, you know, you have 11 segments making up the truss sections. From one solar galactic panel to the other, and in the middle you have the Z1 truss. That was the first truss piece to be put up there, and that was attached to Unity, a living facility. You know, actually Unity and the something called a functioning cargo block by Russia was the first two pieces put up, and then they started with these truss pieces. And this Z1, meaning you know how you X, Y, and Z. Well, it was coming out of the top, so they called it the Z1 structure. It came out of the top, and then I guess along the X axis, you ran all these different segments. And with them, you had solar panels. Let me drop it. The solar panels all rotate and articulate, and they always face the sun. Well, you also have these gigantic ammonia-radiating panels to get rid of the heat. And you've got, off of each segment, you have 8. It's really like 4, to me they're like 4 pairs. You have two gigantic pairs on the port side and two pairs on the starboard side. And attached to each pair, coming out perpendicular in the middle, you have like one thermal radiator. And then, you know, each one of those. So you have 4 of those radiators. And then on the interior, on something called the S1 structure and the P1 truss structure. In other words, the first part's coming off the center of this thing. You have they're just dedicated to these ammonia radiating elements. So you have 2 of them. And they're relatively big. I mean, they're probably, each one is 3 times as big as the individual ones that are coming off the solar galactic panels. So you have basically 6 individual panels, ammonia panels, or ammonia radiating panels, radiators. Back to you, Dave.
Yeah, the article says that if you go to scientificamerican.com/May2011/AMS. AMS stands for Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. On that website, apparently, is a lot more information. John, you had a question for Paul? Go right ahead, John.
Yes, Paul, I have a question. How the hell are they going to supply more ammonia tanks, if needed, without the shuttle? How do they... I assume that's a consumable. Will we need more, and how are we going to get it up there? Back to you.
You got it, Paul.
Yeah, well, they're hoping for what is it, the proton rocket from Russia to eventually, you know, if need be, for any large things that they might need up there. I mean, there's always a possible failure of a solar panel or something that would have, you know, have to be replaced. They just don't. They don't think they're going to be needing these things. They last a long time. There's big tanks attached to the outside now. So I don't know how long it takes to deplete one. a lot of the air and everything is recirculated. You know, they break down everything that they breathe, the carbon dioxide and all, and it's an elaborate system. It's almost like a biosphere. So they don't use that much. A lot of it's fuel. They're bringing up fuel. The space station does have thrusters on board, but that fuel is also bought up by the supply ships. So, I don't know. You know, you've got three different ways, let me drop it, of bringing up stuff. You got the Japanese now have done it already. They have a cargo resupply vehicle launched from Japan. You've got the Progress ships, many of them a couple of times, at least three or four times a year by the Russians. And then you have now the ATV, automatic transfer vehicles, by the European Space Agency, and each one of those is maybe three or four times bigger than what the Russians could carry. So I guess they could always use one of those too if they need, you know, probably put some, maybe a tank on board one of those. I mean, they have a plan B, but right now they'd like to get certain things up there. They're going to leave the robotic arm that's attached to the space shuttle. They're going to leave that. That's not coming back. Certain things, big things that they don't need in the future are going to be left behind. Let me drop it.
Paul, the shuttle is the largest cargo carrier that's in existence as of now?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. I mean, some of these segments are 40 feet long, 14 feet in diameter. That this thing is brought up. Even the Russian, when they launched their first segment, they called the Zarya, their service module, their living quarters. Those things were brought up by proton rockets. That's their biggest lift vehicle. I would say that would probably be not quite as big as what the cargo, you know, maybe half the size of what the shuttle could hold, volume wise.
Okay, wow, it looks like we're going to have to wait a while to get something of decent size. Back to you, Dick.
As I read this article in Scientific American about the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, it is 14 times heavier than the previous gamma-ray telescope they put up on the International Space Station. It weighs 7 metric tons. That is 15,680 pounds. Whoa, that's heavy. Do you happen to know what was the weight of the Hubble Space Telescope, Paul? Was it about that weight? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, that was the heaviest thing that they ever took up because of that mirror. You asked about the weight. I think the last time I remember investigating the weight, I think it was 1 million pounds, 1 million pounds of stuff in orbit. And one of these days we should go through the list of all the different things that are up there, you know, and what order that they went up. You know, you had the, you know, we could go through, and then each, maybe each week you could go over what each one did. You know, you had the FGB, that was a functioning cargo block, the Zarya, and that got attached to the Unity node module. And what that Unity node module did, it had like six one-meter ports coming out of it that you could open up or connect to. And from there, you built everything, you know. out of the back of the Russian thing, you had another Russian living quarters that was attached to it. Let me drop it. And then, then going forward again, coming out of the front of the Unity, you attached the Destiny. That's our United States lab and living quarters. In front of that, you've got another node, another one of these interconnecting Unity type things that they call it Harmony, and all the different things that came out of that. You had the JEM, that was the Japanese contribution. That was another gigantic living area. Coming out of the top of that, another one that was also by Japan. And oh my God, we should go over this. Out of another side, you had the Columbia module. Each one of these things, 30 feet, 40 feet long, 15 feet in diameter. That's just the living quarters. That's not the structure that everything's attached to. It's unbelievable.
KEY.
Almost 1,000,000 pounds. Whoa. Go ahead, Mel.
Case 2, Mike Yankee with a question when you're ready.
Okay. I'm just looking at the Hubble Space Telescope. I got a brochure on it here that I picked up when I was down in Florida at the time. And it says the mass, 11.4 tons, would you believe that? 43 feet in length, 14 feet in diameter. Primary mirror alone is 8 feet in diameter. Do you imagine that, Dick, lifting this thing over?
Okay, 11.4 tons, and this new machine is 7 metric tons. So it's a little bit lighter, still on the heavy side. KC2, Mike Yankee. Start off with your name, sir, and your question. K2LIW, my name is Dick.
K2LIW, it's Ray. Hi, Dick. KC2, Mike Yankee. Maybe there's a simple question for everyone else, but I don't know the answer, so I'm going to ask it. Normally when you have an antenna, you have a certain wavelength of the antenna, extended between trees or whatever you like. And then there's some kind of transmission or ladder line going to it. How is it that the ladder line does not become part of the wavelength of the antenna, or does it, and how does that work?
Ladder line looks to the human eye like it's an open structure. Common sense would lead you to believe it should radiate like gangbusters. It does not, Ray. A coaxial cable, you can easily envision that as a thoroughly shielded structure. That the signal goes down the middle of that pipe, none of it goes to the outside world. It only comes out of the end of the pipe, gets coupled to the antenna, and the antenna does its thing. Ladder line is the exact same thing. When you're using ladder line correctly, in a balanced manner, in other words, the current and voltage on the right-hand side of the ladder line and the left-hand side of the line are exactly each equal to each other, but exactly opposite in phase. It gives you complete cancellation. As long as the spacing between the two wires of the ladder line is a very small fraction of a wavelength, and even though it looks like it's open as all hell to your eye, that is a thoroughly shielded structure. That signal thinks it's going down a pipe, and only when it comes to the end of the ladder line and connects to the antenna is the signal being exposed to the first time. Maybe that helps a little bit, Ray. KC2MMY, K2RIW, K2 Romeo, India, Whiskey. My name is Dick. You got it, Ray.
Okay, but I was generally not necessarily talking about only ladder line, but any kind of transmission line. What if I used coax transmission line? Does that now get, which is unbalanced, does that now have to get calculated into the wavelength?
Lots of guys have done it. Take coax cable, connect the center conductor to the right-hand side of their dipole and the shield to the left-hand side, and it works. When you do that, some of the current does crawl back down the outside of the coax cable outer shield. if you're really being a purist and you don't want the antenna, you don't want the transmission line to be any part of the antenna, then you do use some kind of a bounding device, Unideller and W2AD and or whatever. Various companies make bounding devices. You put it at the end of the coax. And if you want to save money, all you've got to do is take about three or four turns of the coax cable, a couple of feet in diameter, and tape it together as a poor man's RF choke at the end of the transmission line where it connects to the antenna. So one way or the other, by putting an RF choke or by using a bounding device, you can stop any of the RF energy from the antenna to crawl back down the outside of the coax cable. Therefore, the cable is not there. When a cable is really being used correctly and it's doing its thing, your antenna thinks that your hold-on transmitter is in a 1 cubic inch box and it's at the end of that transmission line. It can't tell the difference. Over to you, Ray, K2LIW.
K2LIW, KC2 Mike, Mike Yankee. As a finalization note, is that because is it invisible because the impedances are different? Or, like, you know, if you're choking it, that's kind of maybe some kind of low-pass filter or something? Or, you know, is it an impedance thing? And why doesn't it see it, in other words? That would be my last question.
No, it's got very little to do with impedance. You could, if you want to, design a coax cable that has a 2-ohm impedance, a 50-ohm impedance, or a 200-ohm impedance. As long as you design the antenna correctly to properly match that, you'll get the exact same result. The transmission line, in the case of a dipole, the transmission line is exactly at right angles to the dipole in the normal way you use the dipole. The dipole is creating an E field, which is parallel to the earth, and it's horizontal. Your transmission line in the center of the dipole comes down vertical. It's at right angles to the E field. It doesn't see it. In the case of a Yagi, the boom of the Yagi is at right angles to all the elements. Radio-wise, it's not there. There are people who want to be a purist and they make the boom out of wood or plastic or whatever. You don't have to do that. As long as the metallic objects in the vicinity of the antenna are at right angles to the signal itself coming off the antenna, then it's thoroughly transparent to it. Over to you, Ray. K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. You got it, Ray.
Okay, that kind of makes a little bit of sense. It's kind of weird. It's not readily understandable, I guess, unless you ask someone. But there are many situations, especially in mine, where you're not running at an exact right angle, and then your wavelength piece of wire, whether you're doing a dipole or whatever, isn't always at the right angle either. Like mine bends around corners and stuff. I mean, like, how much of that can you get away with? You don't have to go too deep. We're at the end of the session. I just wanted to get a basic understanding. Here's to Mike, Mike Yankee.
Assume that you had a dipole set up on Convert Avenue in Yonkers, and the dipole is 50 feet in the air, parallel to the earth. And let's assume that there's a Con Ed power line at exactly the same altitude right across the street from you. And right across the street from you is the direction toward London, and you want to talk to a guy on 40 meters in London. A hell of a lot of people will say, hey, the wire of that Con Ed power line on those telephone poles is exactly parallel at the exact same altitude, broadside, directly in front of my antenna. That's going to create a great big shadow toward London. A lot of guys would believe that. Absolutely not. If there was some arcing of the insulators, you may pick up some noise. Let me drop. You may pick up some noise from the Con Ed line, but radio-wise, it's not there. It's transparent. Why? Because that piece of wire of Con Ed is not the resonant length. The magic of resonance. Your dipole, you've cut it to the right length, you've used an antenna tuner, you've resonated it. In the case of an 80-meter dipole, its effective area is 8,500 square feet. If your eyes operated at 80 meters, and you looked at that dipole on 80 meters, it's 130 feet long, you looked at it with your 80-meter eyes, you would see a oval of black stuff in space around that dipole. The oval would be a little bit longer and left to right, you know, the long dimension than the dipole. It would be quite a little bit less dimension, but quite fat compared to the dipole, 8,500 square feet. The wire of that Con Ed power line, it's got a couple of square inches of area to it that's being cast on the, it's casting a shadow onto your 8,500 square feet. It's not there. That's the magic of resonance. If you're a little bit unlucky and that Con Ed wire just happened to be 132 feet long with insulators on the end, and it's a resonating thing, yeah, now it's another element of a Yagi, and all kinds of things start happening. So an awful lot of the wires and things that you see, as long as they're not resonant, as long as they're not a whole lot of area to it, a great big sheet of copper, it's not there. Of course, that's not common sense. You have to look at it from another way. Over to you, Ray.
Okay, well, thank you for that. I got a much better understanding. I did go out and buy some 24-gauge wire, and we're going to try to run the 160 meters, I guess a half. I'm going to run a dipole, so I guess a quarter on each side, but I have to bend it around the house. So I hope that's going to work. We'll see what it does. And thanks for the info. I don't know if I get in your call. I think you keep correcting me. But this is KZ2 Mike, Mike Yang.
You got it right. Yeah, I'm K2 Romeo in the USA. K2RIW. A lot of people hear it as LIW. Must be the way I pronounce it. It's RIW. And the TechNet has been here for 28 years, and I've been associated with it for 28 years. The fact that you've got to zigzag the wire and wrap it around the house, don't worry. It'll work. You may have to use an antenna tuner to give it a good vizwire, but it's going to work. John, I know you had a question. We've been delaying you something fierce. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
I had a quick question from Mel. Are you still out there, Mel?
Yes, sir. Go ahead, John.
Two questions, Mel. I assume you have a three-pole double-throw switch in your shack which disconnects you from Edison, and you bring those three legs to ground, but only on the load side. Is that correct?
Exactly. In other words, that the equipment, no way the equipment can see anything from Edison coming back up, over.
Okay, very good. That sounds like a great idea. And also, your coax that's coming into the house through the wall, do you also have it grounded on the outside of the house besides that grounding plate you have in the house? Do you have the shields brought to ground on the outside?
As they come in the port, it's just a short run, like a foot, so a foot and a half. The plate, that grounding plate, is right there at next to the port, to the left of the port, and to the right of the port is the panel that the antennas were, you know, the individual selected antenna then goes to the right panel, which goes to the equipment. So it's separated that way, but says the only grounding source on the coax is at that point as it enters the shack, over.
Okay, Mel, because I see no problem with what you're doing there. I think that's very effective, but I was just wondering about that on the outside of the shack. But with the way your tower is grounded and everything, I think it would be foolish to even worry about that foot and a half of cable that you're using as a manual switch inside. That's going to give you any trouble. Okay, that was it, Dick. Thank you. Thank you, and back to you.
2EO. Go ahead, Rich.
I think as far as the power line, just to follow up what John was saying and what Mel was saying, over here in Whitestone, in the whole area, all the power lines are underground. The only thing that's above ground is a block away. There are high tension lines. Do I have to worry about anything? I was under the impression no, but I might be wrong. Back to you, Dave.
I think that's a tough one. You're sort of asking the high tension lines, which are up in the air, if a lightning strike occurs to them, could any of that impulse be coupled to the underground wiring? I don't know. I'm having trouble believing that there is a perfect isolation transformer there. Glenn earlier talked about an isolation transformer to be used in the house, and without a doubt it gives you added protection. But if there's a direct strike of a million volts on a 110 volt line or a 220 line, rare but it can happen, would that isolation transformer stand off a million volts between the primary winding and the secondary winding? Of course not. But that's a very rare event. Most of the other spikes that come down the power wiring of Con Ed or LIPA, the isolation transformer is going to give you some benefit.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, we use isopods to keep the lightning out of the power because it does come down the power line. But after you pass through the isopods, and then, of course, we have a delta Y transformer after that, you don't feel anything.
Give us a couple of words on what is an isobar.
Now, the isobar is a long hunk of metal with coils on it. I really don't understand the operation of it, but it works really well. It's just spike suppressor.
I'm both already.
So in other words, there are three inductors on your three phases, and the leading edge of the lightning strike, which is a 20 microsecond event, I think you're telling me it gets absorbed by that RF choke on the three phases, whereas the RF choke itself has a very little impedance to 60 cycles. Therefore, the desired power flows through the three isobars, but the majority of the energy of the lightning bolt, particularly its leading edge, doesn't make it. Is that approximately it, Eric? Go ahead.
That's approximately. I mean, the things are like four and a half feet long, but, you know, they're in a 125 kVA circuit, so, you know, they handle a bit of current, and they're rated at something like 15,000 volts peak or something like that. But the end result is really nice. They get blazing hot when they get hit, but they continue to work.
What's your guess as to their inductance in millihenry, if you happen to know? 4.5 feet long, how big in diameter? When they get hit with lightning, they get hot, but they keep right on playing. Takes a licking, but keeps on ticking. Isobars. Is that a polyphase of product? What's your guess as to who makes that? Over to you, Eric.
No, I think they're made by Superior Electric. They're designed for electric power transmission. They make them small and make them big. They're actually rectangular in shape. They're maybe about half a foot wide by 3.5-4 feet long. And there's one of those things on each face.
I have the small isobars. They have 6 outlets on them. Is that protecting me?
I think you guys are talking about a very different object. The isobars you're talking about, Eric, they're on a how many kilovolt line? And is that the primary going into a step-down transformer? Over to you, Eric.
Negative. We get 448. We actually take, what do we got? We got 4,500 volts going into the main transformer. No, it's 13.5 that feeds the building. Sorry. And that goes down to 480. So the isobar is sitting at 480.
So 13.5, three phases, comes into your facility. I presume very close to your facility is a step-down transformer that steps down 13.5 line to line, and that's probably line to line delta, is my guess, goes into a step-down transformer that gives you 480, three phase Y, is my guess. Over to you, Eric.
That's absolutely right. And then after passing through the isobars, I go into a regulator, which actually looks like a set of variacs on motors. In the city, I used to have something called a Peschel. I really liked that thing. It was a trapped auto transformer with big contactors that would go up and down. It was all servo controlled. And the output of that is delta Y, so we've gone from delta to delta Y.
your Variac thing, your regulator, really is a great big motor-driven servo mechanism that goes up and down to keep the 480 volts, exactly 480 volts, under load, regardless of what's happening coming in or going out. Go ahead.
Yep. Keeps it within 2%. And you can even tell when LiPo switches, because you hear the motors and that thing start grumbling. You know when it's 3 o'clock, you know when it's noon. The thing goes off like clockwork.
What's your guess as to why LiPo has to switch, do some kind of switching at my house they switch at 6 in the morning, in your place 9 o'clock and noon. What kind of switching do you think they're doing?
No, we're pretty close to substation, so they're constantly switching loads and constantly moving them around, because I think the substation that we're sitting next to has something like 5 feeds. And depending upon the time of day, they change the stuff. As to why, I haven't a clue, but since we are in a somewhat industrial area, I suspect it has to do with power usage.
KC2WYE.
Go ahead, Eric.
First, Dick, my audio improve at all?
Audio sounds real good. Go ahead.
Okay, I lowered the mic gain. And with regard to utility switching, it can be done for a variety of reasons, but it's usually scheduled maintenance.
Scheduled maintenance every single day at exactly 9 in the morning and exactly noon time at his location? Over to you, Eric.
Probably that's before the peak, after the peak, going into the peak, and it might not just be their maintenance. It may be maintenance performed by their customers, which require certain outages.
So, are you saying the power becomes interrupted at an extremely specific time for, let's say, 5 cycles, so that somebody can switch something under zero load during that 5 cycles? Is that approximately what's happening?
I'm not familiar with LiPo, but yeah, switching, you may see a flicker, a dip, but it depends on... I don't know whether those are radial or network feeders, but you could experience at least a noticeable event, whether it's a light flicker or something dropping out in your plants, or some evidence that switching's going on. But if it's 9 o'clock every day, or it's probably related to some form of maintenance, either by them or one of their customers.
I heard John. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, Dick, at certain times in the morning, we have different lines coming on or different factories setting up, and their auto tap changers start to swing. And as they swing, the DO's office also has to make adjustments to keep everything happy, and that's probably what you're seeing.
Well, I can say this much. I've had chip charts on recorders on it, and those changes occur at the zero crossing of the power coming in. So it's interesting. It's very regular. When they're doing brownouts and stuff like that, then, all bets are off. The thing goes out of its mind.
K2KY.
Go ahead, Mel.
Question, this guy works for Edison, and he says that what they do, certain times of the day, they buy electric from different sources. So what happens is, he says, in the switching from different sources where they purchase the electric from, I guess it's like a commodity on the market that so-and-so has got extra electric, that they can switch it onto the grid in some way. And he says sometimes you detect that changeover, Dick, over.
KC2WAE.
You got it, Eric.
Those are called switching surges.
In order to make the power flow from Con Ed to the grid in the Midwest, I am guessing Con Ed slightly raises its voltage. And to make the power flow from the Midwest grid into Con Ed, you do the opposite. Is that approximately what happens, KC2WIE? K2LIW.
Outside of New York, I'm not really too familiar with the way they operate. But within New York, for the most part, other than the East, the plant down by me, most of the power comes from the power authority upstate. And it just travels over the Edison distribution network. Edison doesn't really generate that much power anymore.
Don't those nuclear power stations that we have, I can't think of the name of them, on the Hudson River, aren't they generating a fair amount of power?
Point.
Again, I wasn't really involved too much with the nuclear end of their operation. Just their 27 and 13,000 volt distribution service that they provided transit.
That's WAPG.
Indian Point's not part of Edison.
Indian Point's not part of Edison. Interesting. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, and 2ATG, a quick observation, and I had a quick question about the LIPA and their wires and stuff. A couple of weeks ago, I was hiking right across from the Indian Point power plant, and I heard a helicopter flying in the distance, and it didn't seem like it was going anywhere. It was just, hovering. You could hear it, so I eventually got up high enough where I could get my binoculars out and take a look-see to see what was going on, and they were actually flying, the helicopter was flying directly above the power lines that go across the river up by the power plant, and there was a guy sitting on one of the skids outside the helicopter, and he was actually inspecting, touching the power lines all the way across the river. They were inspecting the power lines via a helicopter. Quite fascinating.
You've probably seen that website where a guy does crawl from a helicopter skid, puts a grounding line between the helicopter and the high-tension line, and then crawls over to the high-tension line in order to crawl along that line to do the inspection. Have you seen that movie, Dave? Go ahead.
No, I haven't. But when I got home from hiking, I went online and did a little research, and sure enough, online they explain that this is what they're doing to ensure that the the safety of the plant and all the accoutrements that go with it. They were physically inspecting the towers and the transmission lines, to make sure they were up to snuff and in good shape. But, I mean, the flying that this guy was doing on the helicopter, he was literally hovering, inches above the power line. And physically, there's a guy, sitting in a chair on one of the skids, and his hand is on the power line, inspecting it and stuff. So it's just amazing to see that. And I got a quick question.
Go ahead, Dave. And if I get a chance, I'll mail you a copy of that movie. It's a mind blower. Go ahead, Dave.
Okay, my question just has to do with the, the power lines out on the poles in front of the house. I live very close to Broadway, which is a main drag. And if you look on the top of the poles, there are three wires, that go up and down the block on top of the poles, three wires. Now, in front of my house, I have those same three wires, but the three wires end at the pole in front of my house, and only the center wire of the three is connected to a transformer. The other two wires are not connected to anything. So I'm just wondering, what is the purpose of those other two wires if they're not, connected to anything?
Okay, now you're talking about the transition between transmission and distribution. Almost all high-power transmission is on three phases. They call it phase A, B, and C. The three wires are the three phases. That's transmission. Distribution, in other words, what goes to your particular house is only one of those phases. Those three phases are all 120 degrees apart electronically. Exact same voltage, 120 degrees apart. One of those phases goes to your pole peak transformer. The primary, so to speak, of your pole peak transformer works between that single phase and ground. There's a piece of 6-gauge approximately wire running from the case of that transformer in this wooden U-shaped trough going down all the way down your telephone pole, and it goes to a butt plate, a copper plate at the bottom of your telephone pole. So the one single phase goes into your transformer, your pole pig. The circuit gets completed to ground by that butt plate, and then the secondary, so to speak, of that transformer is 240 volts, 110 each side of neutral, the center tap secondary winding, and those three wires, the red, the black, and the bare one, are the three wires that go to your weather drop, or whatever they call it, the great big wooden post at your house. Does that make some sense, Dave? N2APG, K2LIW?
Yeah, that's exactly what I got. I was just kind of wondering, you know, why would they run the three wires to my pole if only the one wire appears to be necessary? Those other two wires are not connected to anything. So in other words, on the main run, like up and down Broadway where the power is being, it's a transmission line, in other words, that needs the three wires. But when it gets down to the local streets, they only need the one.
If there were enough additional houses on your street, all three wires would run down that street. In theory, one-third of all the residents on a street are on phase A, and all of their pole pig transformers connect to phase A. One-third of the residents on that street are on phase B, and one-third of the residents are on phase C. Those three wires got down to your pole, and even though one is being used at your house, those other two are there so that they have the ability to extend them later if there are more apartments being built and more houses or whatever. But all the real transmission down all of the blocks is all three phases. But in Nassau and Suffolk County, each human being is only on, each house, each private residence is only on one of those phases. In my particular community, a pole pig transformer is on one phase for the primary, and the secondary feeds either two or three houses. That's all. I'm not sure how many houses your particular pole pig transformer feeds. Over to you, Dave, K2LIW.
110 service there today.
Yeah. The secondary of the transformer is 240 volts center tapped, 115 each side of center. Three wires goes into the weather drop into the house. Weather pole, whatever it's called. Over to you, Dave, K2LIW.
Okay, very good. So in other words, those the outer two wires that are don't appear to be connected to anything on my pole, they're still live. In other words, they could, if they needed to, they could extend those wires down the block?
That's my best guess, that they are live and could be extended. Now, when I say Nassau and Suffolk, almost every private resident in Nassau and Suffolk is on one single phase to ground as to the primary of their pole pig transformer. There are portions of Con Ed in portions of the five boroughs which are wired differently. In those cases, the pole pig transformer is sometimes wired between two of the phases. And it's in other words, in the case of Rich into EO, he's got instead of 240, I think he's got 208 or some other crazy number. In other words, your two phases, you've got a red and a black wire and a neutral wire, the bare wire coming into your house. You can measure from neutral to one side, you'll get 115. Neutral to the other side, you'll get 115. One side to the other side, red to black, you'll get 230 in my example. In other words, those two phases are on a center tap transformer. Those two phases are exactly 180 degrees out of phase in Massapequa. When Rich makes that exact same measurement of neutral to red wire and neutral to the black wire, he doesn't see 180 degrees of phase difference. He sees 120 degrees of phase difference. He's got a partial three-phase system. Portions of Con Ed are done that way. I'm not sure why, but most of Nassau and Suffolk are really center-tapped, secondary, 180 degrees between each phase. Over to you, Dave.
I think I get 212 and 122.8.
And as you can tell, 122.8 times 2 would be 245.6, and you're only getting 212. The fact that you're getting a much lower number when you go from line to line tells me that you're on a three-phase system, and you've got two phases coming to your house, and if you use the oscilloscope just right, you would measure the fact that your two phases are 120 degrees apart. In Dave's house, those two phases are 180 degrees apart. And why Con Ed, in certain portions of the five boroughs, does it that way, I'm not sure. Someday somebody's got to explain it to me. It's probably something to do with tradition. Over to you, Dave.
Okay, Dick, very good. We're running out of time, so I'll let you wrap it up. Appreciate the info. I'll send you a quick email with a picture of the helicopter on the wires that I found online. It's pretty cool. And to APG, have a good night. 7-3 all.
Go ahead, Wesley.
Yeah, I wonder if you have a time to just go to one of my questions.
Yeah, Wesley's question number one is that there are kinds of universal power supply. He didn't use that word, but there are kinds of universal power supply which will accept anything from 45 hertz to 500 hertz and anything up to 600 volts. And part of what's going on is that a substantial portion of the world runs on 50 hertz, a substantial portion of the world runs on 60 hertz of the United States, North America. A substantial portion of the world, our world, runs on roughly 120 volts. The majority of the United Kingdom, for instance, runs on 240 volts. So what kind of power is in your house is very, very different depending on what country you're in. Once you accept the fact that you can build a switching regulator power supply, which has smart enough electronics, it can accept any reasonable frequency of power, any reasonable voltage of power, and convert it electronically into what you want. If your universal power supply type of war wart, and there are some of those, you could make a war wart, which always gives you 12 volts at 1 ampere output, no matter what you put into it, as long as it's more than 80 volts and less than 400 volts, and anything from 45 hertz to 600 hertz. You could build an electronic war wart that does that. They're called universal power supply, and once you've got one of those, you can travel to any country you want, as long as you've got the right mechanical adapter, so that the pins of your wall wart pick up the pins that are in that wall, because each one of the wall plugs in each country are different. Where they put the ground, are they round, are they blades, and whatever. Are they triangular shape, are they linear, and so on.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So as long as you've got the right kind of mechanical adapters that you can plug into the pins of your particular wall wart, you can now take that wall wart to any country you want, run your 12-volt radio, and the radio is always happy. It's just a matter of electronic converting. Glenn, KC2QIQ, has done a lot of that kind of work. I wonder if that makes some sense, Wesley. And 2XJN, K2LIW?
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Yeah, I also found the impression that the U.S. Army and Navy, they utilize 45 to 500 hertz, up to 600 volts AC power supplies. Back to you.
WB2HWW, with a comment on this subject.
Go ahead, Howie.
A couple of minutes ago, you were talking about if your house, you're looking at 180 degrees, you're looking at a phase. You're really on a single-phase system. If your house is being fed with one phase, when you say you're 180 degrees out of phase from phase to phase, you really shouldn't say that. It's a center tap transformer. But in reality, you're only on one phase to ground. Richie is on a three-phase system because he's in a commercial area. You know, because when you talk about three phases, you're talking about a delta and a Y. If you're 180 degrees out of phase, that's just because you're looking from one side, you know, top to the bottom of a transformer. Because your secondary, the two phases, are the two legs, and I wouldn't call them phases, are reference to the center tap, because the primary is just hanging across one phase, Dick.
Yeah, 5 minutes ago, maybe you weren't here, Howie. 5 minutes ago, I used those exact words that in Nassau and Suffolk County, each individual pole pick transformer primary is connected to one single phase to ground. The secondary winding of the pole pick transformer is approximately 240 volts with center tap. Those three wires are what comes into the house. So yes, the house really is one phase, but in colloquial language, you've got a red wire, a black wire, and a bare wire coming into the house. Many people call it the red phase and the black phase. And yes, those red and black are 180 degrees out of phase compared to the neutral, the bare wire. But yes, primary pulping-wise, it is one single phase. I used those exact words 5 years ago, 5 minutes ago. Looks like we got to say goodbye. Bye-bye, you all. Meet you all.
you know, 3 o'clock, it's really too late. You're doomed.
Yes.
I know it all too well. I tell the, try to tell the dispatchers sometimes, you know, hey, listen, I need to be home early tomorrow, you know. 1:30, 2 o'clock, start heading me east, but, you know, then if anything else, whatever, I got something to do, I get turned around, I gotta go back in, fix something else. So, I've learned now, when I have something important I gotta do, I just bang in with a sick day.
Do you, drive a commercial vehicle?
Yes, I do. Yep, yep, yep. Yeah, I'm an operating engineer. I run around fixing construction equipment all day long. The five boroughs, parts of New Jersey, all of Long Island. We go everywhere.
You know, I feel your pain. I think we've spoken before. You know, I'm like the lock guy. I cover the same exact area. I talked to a buddy of mine yesterday about going through a truck weigh station, and they stop you there. I have had that happen to me. You know, they stop you and they say your brakes are bad or your tires are bad or whatever, and they make you get it fixed right on the spot. You can't even have the vehicle, you know, 24 hours. You know, you have to have them come. I wonder what they would charge for that kind of service. We were thinking about it.
$6. Big dollars. What I can tell you is, I chase down our own tractor trailers when they get stopped like that. And you gotta call an outside company, it's big time money. So, minimally $1,000. That's a minimum charge.
Okay. Well, that gives me an idea then. I figured it was getting close to that, but figure at least $1,000. Okay. Well, pay the stop, though, and not skirt the weigh station. I'm sure the fine's a lot heavier than that. I've been guilty of that once by accident. I didn't get off to the weigh station. I didn't get pulled over, but I sure sweat and pull it for the next exit.
Yeah, well, that new thing they got now, that free pass thing, that works pretty good. The guys that do a lot of, interstate with the weigh stations and stuff. A couple of my outside guys have that weight, that, what is it called, free pass thing. It's electronically registered weight. They get the green light just before the weigh station, they keep on going.
Yeah, I saw that actually out west years before it was around on the interstates in the Northeast. But, you know, in a lot of the country.
Yep. Anyway, just got on to the good old 495 here. See how I fare this morning. So I'm behind the, I'm usually way west by now. I just had a little bit of a slow start this morning.
This is KC2ZQJ. I got a defective mic on this, so I'm going to sign. Something just happened to my mic. So have yourself a good day and a safe ride today. And KC2ZQJ is QRT.
Alright, no problem there. It didn't sound like a problem, but okay. Been there, know that. Catch you later. KC2ZQJ, W2HTV.
Say again?
Caught in a landslide. Escape from Reality, Little Queen this morning, Bohemian Rhapsody.
Good morning, sir.